This is Melissa, and it is the 21st of June, 2026, and that is summer solstice. I hope that you're all doing well wherever you are, and I want to thank you right off the top here for your support. I received several encouraging emails and a letter, and I'll have to tell you again to write me at CTTM. P.O. Box 815, Keene, K-E-E-N-E, Texas 76059. I love to hear from you. You can send a postcard or a letter. You can also order that way if you like to. Your support is so necessary for me to keep going, but it is good to hear that encouragement that what I'm doing, that you appreciate it. If you go to the website, cuttingthroughthematrix.com, you will see how to donate and order using Stripe. That takes a credit and a debit card. And Cash App, if you live within the United States, is very easy to use. And personal checks within the U.S., cash and foil comes through. So lots of ways to support. I do know I had a little bit of constructive criticism again this week, which we've been getting the same constructive criticism for years, which is about the website and how difficult it is to navigate it. And so I just wanted to say, I have a lot of things that I want to accomplish, big projects, but one of them is finding a way to streamline the website, redo portions of it perhaps, so that A, it's easier for you to find things, to order and to donate, and also many of you access it on your telephone or a tablet, so it doesn't look that good. There's lots of black space, I know that. So I'm hoping that that is something that I'll be able to do, but your encouragement, your words of cheer and, you know, hang in there. It really helps me and I appreciate it. So thank you. I've talked about a couple of recurring themes. One of them is overwhelm and how I see the way in which we're bombarded with news and information that's not that useful to us personally. And I think that this has picked up. It has always been used, obviously, but I believe that it picks up around times of crises and organized events. I think you could point to 9/11 and the aftermath. You can certainly point to COVID and the ongoing aftermath of that, to see this technique in action. And I've also said several times recently that I witnessed during COVID a resetting of the voices that comprise the patriot, alternative, dissident, whatever you want to call that. Those voices changed, and the way and the platforms on which they operated changed, and that all seamlessly took place during COVID. And then a lot of the people who seemed to have some legitimate credentials and expertise in whatever, virology or worked in pharmacology, pharmaceuticals, these people came out and they were the experts that we are now left with, who weigh in on a regular basis on geopolitics. And it's not, for me, it isn't a comfortable landscape to navigate because I don't really trust anybody. It's just that simple. So I'm back to basics. I've said this, I'm saying it again. And for me, that's listening to Alan more, reading his books more, thinking about things that he said and wrote, and approaching it from a different vantage point. So the redux for today is the third in this series that Visigoth had called The System, and I think that was a good title. These conversations were recorded in December of 2005, and then they were released in January of 2006. And so this is the third and final in that series. And I want to thank Stuart in England. Stuart has done lots of great work for CTTM in cleaning up audios. He's particularly focused on the conversations that Alan had with Jackie Petru. And now I asked him if he would concentrate on some of the Visigoth interviews, because they're all good. It's not just these three, but others. And he's done that. And he's worked on others. And I also want to point out that he added in the nice thumbnail here. So the picture of Alan with all of that description is something that Stuart's done. And I appreciate that, because as I get back to basics, as I do real soul searching and schedule maneuvering to decide what's really important, I find myself increasingly pressed for time. I think you'll notice some changes. I can't really announce what they'll be because I'm not sure yet, but I am going to shift things and concentrate more in certain areas and less in certain others, because as I've said a couple of times this year, it's 5+ years since Alan has been gone. And while I've done some of the things that I've set out to do, there's so much more to do. So it's back to basics. So there's overwhelm. I think it's a technique. We watched the resetting of those voices, and I don't trust many of them. I don't feel that they have expertise that is appropriate to the task of addressing where we are. There's so many people who talk, myself included, and I can't claim to have the best handle on geopolitics. But many people did. They seamlessly made that move from, you know, the world of talking about COVID into the world of talking about geopolitics. And so there's a little bit of the blind leading the blind. And I don't want to be part of that problem. So I go back to basics and I listen to Alan and reflect on what he has said. So there's so much good that is in this talk. And one of the kind of basics with Alan's work is Freemasonry. His knowledge of Freemasonry was so profound. I know I can see that by looking at the bookshelves. I can see that by picking up books of his and looking at his notes and the dog ears, and just very deep. And you can even hear it. Like I'm always amazed by him, frankly. And so he's talking to Visigoth, and Visigoth is not by any means a dull knife. He's deceased sadly about a year ago, year and a half ago now. But he was an intelligent man who had done a lot of homework and research on his own, and they had good conversations. And so they talked about Freemasonry and the significance of some of the symbols that we see that we're surrounded by. And Alan said something very important, and I don't know why, but I turned on the mic before I pulled up the transcript for it. But he said something to the effect that Freemasonry is the world's religion. So we talk sometimes about the coming religion, that the Abrahamic religions will recede, or, you know, what's going to be the new religion? Is it this, the UN favored Baha'i? Is it what's the new thing for the new age? Because remember, this is what Alan told us for 20 years. We are going into the new age, a new age. we are leaving Pisces, going into Aquarius. This is, you know, debatable when it is happening, but Alan, a lot of what Alan wrote about and talked about is now or very near. And so I just want to point out in looking at the news, I'm doing my little jumping all over the place thing that I seem inclined to do. But there was a G7 summit in Evian, France, from the 15th to the 17th of June. So this year, just now. And this is from the European Council, Council of the European Union. And they're telling you about what it is here. And there's just, so this little page I've pulled up said where it was and who represented the EU and some of the statements that different people made. So Antonio Costa is the president of the European Council. And he said, this G7 summit is taking place at a defining moment. The choices we make here will send a clear signal about our willingness to act, to cooperate, and to defend the principles that underpin global stability. They voiced some people, some leaders there voiced unwavering support for Ukraine. There's a statement here from the G7 leaders. We reaffirm that the right of transit passage without restrictions or tolls is the bedrock of international trade, having to do with the Middle East and the announced memorandum of understanding between the United States and Iran. So it goes on with different things that were affirmed, different leaders' statements on geopolitical issues. Here's one here. We recognize that a swift return to free and safe transit through the Strait of Hormuz without any form of charges and a lasting resolution to the conflict are imperative to mitigate these negative impacts and support more balanced, durable, and resilient global growth. Now, the Children's Online Safety Forging New Partnerships. Now, listen to this, because again, I'm going to talk about Freemasonry as Alan used that in his talks, in his approach to seeing the system, the agenda, and in his writing. So this is a Masonic statement that I'm about to give you. This has to do with forging new partnerships and rebuilding international solidarity. And so President Costa of the EU said, now is the time to move beyond the traditional donor-recipient model towards partnerships of equals, which are mutually beneficial, and to make progress in reforming development cooperation and modernizing the global financial architecture. Now is the time. Whenever you hear that, you're listening to someone who, you may not be able to prove the Masonic connections, but so you caught that he said, now is the time, and we've got some architecture in there. The very first page of the very first book, there's three volumes combined as one in Cutting Through, 1999. Alan wrote this first volume entitled The Androgynous Hermaphroditic Agenda. And Alan gives you the symbol of the female as the downward facing pyramid, open, two-sided. Next to that is the male, the erect, the upward facing. So that is the compass and the square. The square, which opens up to above, is female, and the compass, which opens to beneath it, rising upward like an obelisk, like a phallic symbol, that is the male. So the compass is male, the square is female. This is Masonry. This is the six-pointed star, as above, so below. we're surrounded with this. Everywhere we look, we see the symbolism. And I mentioned before, this is kind of a book club thing, but I'm going to go ahead and talk about book club for a moment. We are covering Morals and Dogma, and don't panic because I've only just finished chapter 5. I did notice that chapter or degree 5 through 8 are less pages, so I don't have that much to read between now and next Saturday because our meeting will be on Saturday the 27th. So far, we've set it at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. I've had a little bit of interest from Australia, and I'm not, I know that's a difficult one because to get Europe in and to get North America in and then to try how to figure to get Australia in. So I'm like, what? That's 2 a.m. I don't get it. That's so I may do a little bit of work there and we'll talk about it. But Morals and Dogma, Albert Pike. And what I conceived when I had the idea is that this will be an excellent book to read before we start on Alan's Cutting Through books. But as I've gotten started on it, I'm blown away by it because there's so much truth in there. There's so much truth in all of the Masonic literature that I've picked up. The thing is that I have never read anything, you know, cover to cover. I've looked up things for Alan before, specific things. He'd say, look up something. And then I'd go do that. Prince sent me my very own beautiful copy of Manly P. Hall's Masonic, Hermetic, Kabbalistic, and Rosicrucian's Symbolical Philosophy. It's a beautiful book. And I've looked things up there. I've looked things up in Albert Mackay's works. But to read it, and I'm reading it a clip. That's another thing. I'm encouraging you because I'm telling you that I'm not retaining that much as I read through it. But what leaps out at me, some of it's just flat out amazing. But there's not a quiz, you know, that's what I'm saying. It's not a university course. There isn't a syllabus for this as we did for Waiting for the Miracle, which I in hindsight, I'm not sure was such a great idea, speaking of overwhelm. But it's just read one of the things that I want to say here is what gives you understanding is important to you. What brings you insights, that's the thing to hold on to and to be excited about and to follow that lead. Someone asked me recently about someone out there who was talking, what I thought of him. And I wasn't really familiar with this person's work, and I did a little looking in it, and I made some comments, and then later I felt bad for the statements that I made to this person, because I don't know that talker. I don't know his heart. I'm not going to know a man or a woman unless I have a lot of interaction with them. If I'm sitting across the table with them or listening to them for, I mean, some people are very clearly controlled opposition. It becomes obvious when you start paying attention to it. But I can't be the last word for who is a source of useful information to you. And I've had these things said about me. I've had people say ugly things about me that I know are not true. I don't want to say that about somebody else. So that's just a little aside there. The deeper that your own understanding is from source material, the easier it is for you to make a judgment call for yourself, what you think. And the reason why I felt bad when this person wrote me and asked my opinion is because when Alan got those kinds of queries, he would either say or dictate to me to say, go with your own gut. Use your own intuition here. And that's really what matters. And that is what matters. Now, yes, I heard him, and I took dictation on several things. There were some people, I won't say names now, but let me say maybe a half a dozen names that were active at that time, because it's new voices, you know, but that were active at that time. And Alan just called a spade a spade. Yeah, that person's not who they pretend to be. So, but back to basics, back to Alan. What I'm seeing in Morals and Dogma, what I'm seeing when I'm now, because I'm doing a little bit of side-by-side reading with some other Freemasonic literature, is I'm understanding the way that they trained and train their managerial class. And Alan talks to Visigoth about that in this talk. And I'm seeing it now in the writing. You see these amazing truths and then the twist, the spin. So you can see how slowly people's minds are being changed. You get a lot of people who, you know, Freemasonry is so, you know, so old school. It's so, you know, 2002 shortwave radio. But it isn't. As Alan said, this is the religion that runs the world, and other complementary secret societies where people take oaths. Again, when you read their literature and they talk about how, you know, wonderful it is, brotherhood and, you know, equality and freedom and all of that, if it's so good, why the vow of secrecy? Why can't it just be out in the open? So anytime you have that kind of secrecy where something is hidden, and that really is the whole point, and that comes through quite transparently in reading Morals and Dogma. Alan told Visigoth that the Cutting Through books, the first two volumes, dealt with Freemasonry, but it's much more than that. As Alan has said in other places to other people, these books are written in a nonlinear fashion. They're written in they're disruptive, actually, to your thinking. So it helps break up what you expect to get in a book. You're going to see things from a different angle. And I always do when I reread them. But I find that it applies to other things, like when I was illustrating the Alan portion of this video, which I did first because I like to hear him talk before I talk. But I, he was discussing the number 9-11, the numbers 9-11, and the significance of them. And he was saying, you know, he's talking about the old emergency number in Britain was 999, and upside down, if you were dialing out on an old rotary phone, it would look like a 666. And he said these numbers are always chosen for very significant reasons. And even Freemasons themselves at the lower level, you can hear them online musing about why 9-11 was the day that the towers came down. And 9-11 was the day that they attacked the Pentagon. A couple of lower level Freemasons I was listening to today were musing on the timing of the attacks, the 9-11 attacks on the Pentagon. And one of them said, well, perhaps they knew that construction on the Pentagon began on September 11, 1941, and that was exactly 60 years before the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. Well, yes, there's always significance in these numbers. He and Visigoth were talking about that significance, and as I was looking for something to illustrate that part of their conversation, I pulled up the Roman numerals and I looked at the 9 and 11 with the 10 in between them. Now, the 10 is so important The nine, if you visualize that, and you can wait to, I'll give you the same illustration again here. But the nine and the 11 are a mirror of one another. And I was thinking about the significance of the reflecting pool. The woman in Freemasonry, the female reflects the male. Now, here are things that you learn. And are you just learning it to stuff your head full of knowing? No, you're learning it because it helps you see what's going on around you. So this is from the Cutting Through Volume 1. Alan gives us a picture of the goat of Mendes, the god of lust, and shows the position of the hands. This is a famous illustration. Two fingers represent the duad, the male-female combined. The moon is on the wane, on the way out. A warning to women with eyes to see. So now I'm going to just refer quickly over here to... So Manly P. Hall, in his book, Masonic, Hermetic, Kabbalistic, and Rosicrucian Symbolical Philosophy, is talking about the significance of numbers here. He's got a diagram, the hieroglyphic plan by Hermes of the ancient zodiac. He said, the houses of the zodiac become the thrones for 12 celestial hierarchies, or, as certain of the ancient state, 10 divine orders. Pythagoras taught that 10, or the unit of the decimal system, was the most perfect of all numbers, and he symbolized the number 10 by the lesser tetractys, an arrangement of 10 dots in the form of an upright triangle. What is the upright triangle? The upright triangle is the male. What is the number 10? As Alan explained to Visigoth, it is the male and the female combined. It's the hermaphrodite. So when Alan writes there, the moon is on the wane, the woman is on her way out, that's what he's talking about. Now, I've mentioned recently my fascination with photo 51, the thing that we're told led to discovering DNA. So it's an X. X marks the spot. This is the most ancient sign. It's the cross. It's the cross. It's the T that is crossed. When you look, again, this is coming from Manly P. Hall, but he's giving an interesting diagram of a Masonic apron with symbolic figures, and you see the X. What else happened at G7? See, this is what we're given, the kayfabe, the wrestling. Speaking of wrestling, we know that Trump celebrated his 80th birthday with a big wrestling thing last weekend. Trump insults Maloney again amid spat over G7 photo claims. This is so junior high school. It's so ridiculous. It's just ridiculous. Trump said, she begged me to take a picture with her. She wanted a picture with me so badly. I wouldn't have taken it, but I felt sorry for her. And so Maloney is offended. I didn't beg him for a photo of us together at G7. Is this not the most ridiculous thing? Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni asked over and over for a picture with me during the G7 meeting in France, Trump wrote in a Truth Social post. Absolutely ridiculous. Now, most people are saying about Iran that it looks like we lost and Iran gets all the concessions if you look at what's really going on. And, Trump said the whole ostensible reason for being over there was they can't have any enriched uranium nuclear weapons. And that was never the goal. I'm going to post an article from Patrick Wood of Technocracy News, and that is Iran. The goal was always economic reintegration, not containment. And it's and it is interesting. I don't agree with everything that he said, but we do know from listening to Alan for years that bringing everyone into the same system is the goal. So there are some truths here. There's some good things. Now, I will also post a link to the actual memorandum of understanding between the U.S. and Iran. Don't hold your breath because Israel's doing what Israel does. So we'll see. But speaking of secret societies, a leak exposes members of Peter Thiel's Secretive Dialogue Society. More than 200 of the world's elites registered for a retreat whose agenda runs from panels on cult building and sex to prepping for World War III. An associated app offers matchmaking. A trove of internal records from a secret society for powerful figures in U.S. politics, finance, and tech was left exposed online, Wired has confirmed, naming participants in its events and revealing sensitive personal details they were assured would stay private. The group, called Dialogue, is a private, invitation-only organization co-founded in 2006 by the billionaire tech investor Peter Thiel. It convenes U.S. officials, foreign government figures, and Silicon Valley executives at off-the-record annual retreats. Dialogue has spent two decades declining to disclose its members. So some of the things now, who knows if, what they're going to do, if they'll reschedule the retreat, but it was going to happen August 12th through 16th at a venue in Dublin, Ireland. And some of the program sessions were money does, in parentheses, buy happiness. Bring back nuclear was one of the topics. Navigating World War III. Battlefield technologies. Remember, Peter Thiel is the guy who's, you know, Palantir. Another topic here is, how's your sex life? Other talks include build a cult. And this was to be moderated by the founder of the Christian networking site, Pray.com, and build a party run by a former White House national security official. Now, one last little thing here in the news, which I don't have up. That's okay. I can remember what it was. The reflecting pool that they call the Lincoln Memorial Reflecting Pool. It's a long rectangular basin at the National Mall, and that's between the Lincoln Memorial and the Washington Monument. Has gone all scummy and green. And I guess the government put like $14 million into cleaning it up and resurfacing the bottom. And this is all, you know, it's the 250th anniversary of the United States, July 4. And so they wanted to clean it up, and it's not working. So they've got these people out. I'll post a link there. They've got a crew that's just cleaning it up all the time. Now, there was some accusation about an Olympic canoer that he had done some kind of vandalism to the pool. And he said, I just reached my hand in. I was out, for some exercise and reached my hand in, and he got arrested. He got handcuffed and everything. So there's algae there. Now, the reflecting pool faces, again, it's between the Lincoln Memorial and the Washington Monument. What is the Washington Monument? The Washington Monument is a phallic symbol. It's an obelisk. And it faces a reflecting pool. What is the reflecting pool? It is the female. The female is being cleaned up in the hopes that she's ready for the big party. But that's what it is. I'm going to post a couple of things here when I talk about back to basics that are links that talk about the Masonic Washington, D.C. So the architects, I think the main architects of Washington, D.C. were someone named Pierre Charles L'Enfant and Benjamin Henry Latrobe. And then the founding fathers who had, you know, Freemasonic connections, I'm sure there were much more than George Washington and Benjamin Franklin, but all of the men that I've just stated had Freemasonic connections. The city is laid out in geometric patterns that include a pentagram that's formed by circles like DuPont Circle and another one that is, it has a different name. And they point towards the White House, and then there's a hexagram that is integrated in to the layout of the avenues. Lots of different compass and square symbolisms throughout the area. The House of the Temple is the southern headquarter of the Scottish Rite in D.C., featuring 33-foot columns, sphinxes, all of the symbolism. Now, I probably won't go find documentaries and clips and things on YouTube. This is all over the internet that you can find this kind of exposés. The reason why I want to bookend Alan's work with different Freemasonic writers, maybe do one of his volumes and then do Albert Mackay, History of Freemasonry, do the third volume, and it's because the deeper, the more profound your understanding is, the less likely you're going to jump on every thing that is put out there. Because these systems, when I talk about a managerial class, who are the talking heads? Who are the experts that have come out? Who is the media? Who are the politicians? What are their affiliations? And you'll never really know because they're sworn to secrecy. So to me, these are amazing shortcuts. As Alan said to Visigoth, the first two volumes of the Cutting Through books deal with Freemasonry, show you how the system works. I think that's it for me today. I appreciate your support. Take care. Have a great week. If you're interested in book club, you will be added to the list. Send an email. There's a few people that have emailed in the last couple of weeks. You will be added onto the list and you'll get that Zoom link. For those of you who were there for the Jung's Undiscovered Self, then that same link is going to work for you this upcoming Saturday. I've just simply changed the name and it's now Morals and Dogma. Thanks so much. Take care.
Well, it's that time again, and welcome to another segment of The Grassy Knoll. This will be heard sometime in January 2006, we hope. This is Viz, and we have with us Alan Watt for the third part of a three-part series that I loosely titled The System, because the first two segments, Alan addressed basically what makes the world go round and always has, and that's the economic system. It's all about the money. In this third segment, Alan's pretty deep in knowledge about Freemasonry, which is another system, a belief system, if you will, a spiritual system, if you will, and we're going to direct most of our discussion today toward that. Alan, thanks a lot for being with us today, and again, for the third time here on The Grassy Knoll.
Yeah, it's a pleasure, yeah.
And what'd you say, about a foot of snow cover up there?
No, it's about that.
Well, it's nothing compared. We got to deal with 50-degree temperatures down here. It's horrible.
Yeah, amazing,
I know,
isn't it? Yeah.
I know. And most of the people that live by you are down by us anyway, so.
Sure. Well, it's 20 below last night. So.
What?
20 below last night.
Are you talking Fahrenheit?
Yeah.
Holy mackerel, how far are you from Hudson Bay?
Well, that's a bit east of me. Yeah. That's a long trek with snowshoes.
Let me ask you this. Have your tires ever turned square?
They have. They have got bumps in them after a cold night. Yeah.
Holy mackerel. I spent two winters in Vermont. That was enough for me. Mm-hmm. Minus 35 below brought tears in my eyes.
Well, last year, at 40 below.
You beat me.
And 40 below, there's hardly anything left in the thermometer to
No!
To pop, so...
You're absolutely right. When I went in and looked at the thermometer, I knew we were going to have an all-time low. I went down to this old lilac tree outside the house, and I'm looking for the mercury. I couldn't find it. It never came out of the ball.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. Do you have any facial hair?
Have what?
You have a mustache or anything?
I got a bit of a beard.
Well, I'll tell you what. I always thought it was a joke about snapping off a mustache.
Yes.
I had one at the time. It's no joke. Oh, that could have happened.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, thanks for being with us again. As I said, it's really been enjoyable. About Freemasonry, this is something that, it has kind of like two lives. You got the guys down the end of the block who are basically Blue Lodge, I think, first to third degree Masons, and who do good stuff and go bowling and have a couple of brews. But they have no idea, do they, about what the higher degrees are doing and just what a history that those individuals have had behind them, do they?
No, they don't. It's a need-to-know basis. It's like any secret society or security good company. It's the same idea. And even though they say that everything is contained within the first 3 degrees, that's very off-putting. It covers the real intentions because it's really a selective system. That's what it's for. It's to bring them in and filter them through and select the ones who will go higher into the other realities, you might call them. If you even have a small newspaper in your area, they will tap you out into a side lodge, another lodge, like the Black Lodge, for instance. And you won't tell the Blue Lodge brothers where you're going or anything about it. And from there you'll be coached because you can now create public opinion in your area, so you're useful to the system.
I've not heard the term Black Lodge before. What would that refer to?
There are all the lodges are color coded. It's all Pythagorean.
Okay.
And of course, the Blue Lodge is supposed to be the open lodge, the blue of the sky. You know,
okay.
Where it's more, whatever's done there is more open amongst themselves, even though they don't understand the ceremonies that have gone through. They think they do, but as Albert Pike said, they don't. They're intentionally misled. So then they go into the Black Lodge. And that's where the secrecy occurs, of course. Now the real oath begins, and you're groomed for much higher positions within the Masonic fraternities.
Two quick questions about the degrees and also about the two branches of Freemasonry. Mm-hmm. With regard to the Scottish Rite,
yeah.
Some say that because of its geometric relationship, that there are lodges beyond 33, that perhaps they go up to 360. Have you found anything that would confirm that?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah, oh yeah. In fact, Alistair Crowley, who began in the English Grand Lodge, and he joined it, by the way, because he was tapped out of the Church of England. He was at a church service when he was tapped to come into Freemasonry.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's also where they select the people within the churches. And he went on eventually, he was groomed by the British Secret Service, and he worked for them all his life. And his job was to go out into the world and create other sects, which would attract youngsters in under the form of magic and so on. So he founded the OTO.
Oh, okay.
But prior to that, he was also a member, after the English Lodge, he joined the French Lodge and a few other ones. So he was a world traveler. Then he founded the OTO. He trained the people who eventually went off to found other sects. And this is how they do it, just like the monks in the Middle Ages did it. They would found a monastery, give them a name and a charter, and then they would then spawn off another one with another speciality, you might say. So each type is a special lodge. So the OTO was set up by Crowley. It spun off the two guys who created the Church of Satan and also Scientology.
With L. Ron?
Yep.
Also,
so all of these things are actually Freemasonic, you see.
Have you ever read or had any exposure to Craig Heimbichner's OTO?
Yes,
All right, and so he was saying this is beyond Freemasonry. So if we do, in fact, go above 33rd degrees, are we entering, say, the OTO section of Freemasonry that goes into higher degrees?
That's one way of doing it. There's other side branches that do the same thing from all other lodges. And it's open in their own books. The OTO will tell you they have 97 degrees.
And by the way, Chaim Bickner's book is Blood on the Altar. I had a little senior moment there, but he's been on the show twice. I thought he did some pretty good work. Mm-hmm. Also, are you familiar with Jan van Helsing's work, Secret Societies and Their Influence in the 20th Century, something to that point? Because he talked about there were 99-degree lodges. Are you familiar with that at all?
Yeah, I've had them as well.
Huh? Would you confirm that that, in fact, is substantive?
I think that only was for a short period of time. Even in prior to the French Revolution, they had a select bunch trained for revolution, and they had the most of the parliament that they formed after the revolution was formed or staffed by these particular masons at that degree. Yeah,
I have.
They called them the ancients. Yeah.
I have his book in a PDF format, and I've not looked at it for a while, but I was intrigued by the fact that I think he might have even said that the 99 lodges existed in the time of Hitler, and of course there's another whole connection there. Do you think for any way or purpose that those lodges no longer exist? You seem to think that might have been timed out?
They might have, or transformed into another branch, because what they're created for really is a special job, a special function for a particular time period.
All right, now I'm going to run this by you, too, and I'm a little reluctant because it's out there, but, you know, we are talking about the occult, and it is supernatural. Mm-hmm. Van Helsing also said that in those 99 lodges that demons were at the head of them.
Yeah, is this from England, this guy Van Helsing?
You know, the book was a translation, and of course, the name Van Helsing, I think he might be Dutch.
Okay.
That's my guess, and if you don't mind, if I can, well, it's kind of hard now, I know, in snail mail I can do this. I can forward you the book that I have in PDF file.
Okay, because I've been in touch with a Van Helsing from London over the last couple of months, who's been having a lot of chats with me.
Well, would his name be Jan? Jan?
His first name isn't Jan, but it's a very unusual surname.
Well, Van Helsing goes back to Dracula, too.
Yes.
That's got some name. All right, we'll do that after the fact, and I have no problem with that. I'm sending you a CD for you to look at that. I mean, that was pretty heavy stuff. Going back also to, I said I had two questions. We talked about the Scottish Rite Freemasonry. What is the genesis of the York Rite?
The York Rite supposedly was formed. The traditional story is that it was a 17th century or 18th century creation. Maybe that's when some of it came into the open, because there was always a noble order in England, even from the Knights Templar days. They had never disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And they always kept the old mysteries inside noble classes, basically, in all countries. And coming up to the Industrial Revolution, they needed a middle class to manage the system. And so that's why they came up with the Blue Lodges and so on for Freemasonry, to bring in this new up-and-coming class who would still keep order by being taught this particular system of masonry. But it was the lowest order, you know. It was really for non-noble people.
I've talked to a couple of people. I have been reluctant to talk to my uncle, who's now in his mid-80s, about his lifetime involvement with the Masons.
Yeah.
And I remember being maybe 8 or 9 years old and brought to the temple in Hoboken, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And as a kid, I wandered free. And I went into, I guess, what do you call the inner hall where they actually have the ceremonies?
Yeah, there's lots of temple, really.
All right. And, I mean, I was there, and I kind of knew I shouldn't be there. I don't really remember much. There was a stage. I can't remember if the floor was checkerboarded or not. And I do remember that a cleaning man came in, and I hid under a desk. Yes. Until he was done, and I came running out. But, you know, only about a month or two ago, without pressing him, because this is not fair now to talk, you know, to grill him.
Mm-hmm.
But I asked him, I said, you know, I kind of beat around the bush, and I said, what was your involvement? And he said, I was only in the Blue Lodge.
Yeah.
Now, I have had other people tell me, and I respect them. They're not, you know, whatever. I wanted the truth, no matter what. Mm-hmm. And they said, even if you're in the Blue Lodge, you got to know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Pike would say differently. What do you think, Alan?
The whole trick in Freemasonry is never to press someone with a superior degree for information. It's knowing what not to ask, really.
So are you saying that if he didn't want to go there, he didn't have to even know that it was there?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. All right, because, I mean, he's been a church-going Methodist. I cannot find anything in his walk or anything that would belie the fact that he was a cult. Honest to goodness, and Lady Viz, I think you would agree with me. I mean, he's a decent individual.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you know, he's had a lifelong attachment to it, and yet I don't see anything.
Mm-hmm.
I only probed him a certain amount, and I think that was only fair. But you know, regardless, there is, as Pike said, the porch members. I guess you would say they would be Blue Lodge.
Yeah.
That are in the community that do basically some good works, just like the Freemason Shriners do, to a certain degree, and no pun intended.
Yep.
And but yet behind this, there is a very occult depth.
Yeah.
And that's what we're talking about today. Now, two things. One, we had mentioned in a conversation, and I find it very interesting, when a student at the university for which I work, which is Catholic, was looking for the origins of monks, of the monastics.
Mm-hmm.
I told her, I really don't know. Let's do a search.
Mm-hmm.
And she came up with the fact that the first monks came out of Egypt.
Yeah.
Now, of course, I have since found out that the Catholic Church denies that.
Mm-hmm.
But would you agree, one, that in fact is true, and what does that bode? And I'm not going to slam the Catholic religion, but I have to admit there's a certain kind of connection between the Vatican and, you know, Egyptian sun god worship.
Yeah.
Can we say that, yes, the monks came out of Egypt?
Yes. In the Irish histories, it's well recorded and documented that the first missionaries that brought Christianity to Ireland in the first century and second century A.D., were actually from Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reason you have the same carvings and so on the graves, which is sort of like a maze-type shape, you know. These are all Egyptian symbols that they brought with them. And in fact, they were up in Ireland for about 600 years, or 600 A.D., and before the Catholic Church started to try to penetrate. But these Egyptians had a different form of Christianity. It was a Gnostic-type Christianity.
Gnostic, okay. But, and I am curious, I've heard this from other sources as well, about the, attraction to Ireland. But why, Alan? Why do you think they might have circumvented Britain, or what we knew as Britain at that time, and gone to Ireland? Was there something there? Was there anything about the Celtic or Gaelic heritage that made them more open?
I think it probably was. There was some kind of connection. We get a confusing history of Ireland because supposedly that there's some different group or races actually in Ireland. You had the Milesians who came across, the darker haired ones who came through Spain. Eventually, when you say Milesians, it's with a T, for T-I-A-N, and that's where the word military came from, or militia came from.
Okay.
Because everybody in the tribe was part of their natural militia. And, then there's another group came in later who were red-haired, green-blue-eyed type. So you had a mixture of people there, and for some reason, the Egyptian priests thought this important. And that's possible it was the same two groups who ran even ancient Egypt at one time. the same racial extract, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Because Egypt, we know that the pharaohs, right, and going back to Sumer, same thing, that the pharaohs wore, and the nobility of Egypt all wore wigs, black wigs, and that they were made from the hair of the local people. But their own hair was generally a red color, and their eyes were green.
Hmm.
And they also wore fake beards, you know.
Jeez.
So, they're found these in the tombs, and found them too in the, one of the big tombs they unearthed, the Sumer, of a king and queen. So, there's a connection between the red hair, for sure, and the green eyes, yeah.
Okay, now, all right, now, I don't mean to digress, but you just triggered something. I had read, about a year ago, that there was some kind of archaeological dig in Western China, and they came up with a red-haired individual. Do you remember this?
Yeah, they figured they're around 3000 BC.
All right.
And the Chinese do have ancient records of these people coming in to the outskirts of their countries.
Were they coming from the west necessarily?
It seemed to be there was a trade route there, and there were semi-nomadic people, but it's thought that they may have brought goods with them. So they may have been traders. It's hard to tell. They have found the graves, of many of the graves on this particular trade route, and they seem to be into a pantheistic form of worship because especially the women were often tattooed with odd markings that may be celestial orientated.
Mm.
And they also used hashish, you know.
All right, so what I mentioned might, in a sense, have some kind of connection through some perhaps or Euro-Indic tribe from way back when.
I think so. I think India, one of the countries least spoken about, is a big player.
Yes, yes.
And always has been, because they were the main traders to Sumer, you know, 5000 BC. People forget this all came from the Indic Valley, and these actual Indian traders set up a halfway port for all trade goods in the island of Bahrain off Africa, and that's where the Sumerians had to transport all their stuff for trade. So the Sumerians primarily traded wool from sheep. And got all the goods, their pottery and various other things from India, at this particular exchange port.
A listener to the show, who now lives in Vancouver, lives there now, was born in India, and he has said something to me, which is interesting because I believe he's right. I don't know on what side this will all come down. But with a look, as we believe in Scripture, about what might happen in the end days, he's saying, don't discount India. And, you know, we really do. We kind of overlook that giant.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing is now we look at it and we say, well, okay, well, they're not really at peace with Pakistan, Muslims. They're not at peace with China.
Yeah.
So, what, you know, does this have any kind of bearing on Jerusalem and where do they all fit in?
Mm-hmm.
But certainly a nation of that size.
Yeah.
We definitely overlook it. Do you have any kind of take on where India's role might be in the coming decades?
Well, what is interesting is that there are so many authors coming out of Britain right now who are sort of under the guise of exposing the system are also promoting the New Age.
Okay. Maitreya? Are we talking about Maitreya?
That's only part of it. I mean, all of this is connected to MI6. All of it.
British intelligence.
Yes, and all these main authors as well, because MI6 has a department outside the Cotswolds area of London where they train people, selected individuals, to go out into the world to create mysticism and confusion.
Did Orwell fit in that at all?
No, he didn't, no.
Okay.
He was picked right from university, from Cambridge, to be a partial revolutionary, and a writer, of course, but he wasn't attached to the MI5.
All right, so his presence in India really is just coincidental.
Yeah, he was following his father's footsteps.
Okay.
He went to Burma, you know.
MI6, would you call that the American version of the CIA, which is supposed to be external, not internal?
It's supposed to be, yeah. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
But people also forget that Britain still has the British Secret Service, which has always been there, and they only recruit from aristocracy. And that's above all of them.
Mm-hmm.
So they have all the power to do whatever they wish, basically. But these offers are coming out of Britain right now under the guise of exposing the coming new order, are also pushing the new age phenomenon. Now, they started this whole thing back in the 1880s with Madame Blavatsky.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And the idea was to promote a change, a sort of phase shift in people's thinking to possibility thinking, by saying that they could, by mystifying them again, always give them mystery, which intrigues them.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe they'd start to fall away from the regular churches and start into, the exploration of theosophical occultism. Now, Blavatsky, I'm sure, was a front person herself.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal really was to eventually prepare the public for merging of Christianity with Hinduism,
mm-hmm.
for the New Age.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what we're seeing promoted.
Well,
it definitely is. Now, again, going back to India, and looking at how that's been run almost untouched for the thousands of years with its caste system, a perfect ordered caste system, where if you're born into the lower caste, you simply accept it and you're a slave, and that's what you do as a slave. You don't complain. No one rebels. They all accept this caste system. And that apparently is what they want to reintroduce into the new system that they're bringing about all over the world.
Well,
they actually want to bring in a caste system. The Lord of the Rings was all about that.
Mm-hmm.
Under the guise of different pixies, elves, a different order, right down to the troll type at the bottom. And even the dead that helped them to win the war, that's the general public. But that was promoting the perfect harmony of that caste.
Well, I look at the time machine now, and I can't look at it ever again the same way. It came to me, you know, in a movie that had Rod Taylor in it back at the early 60s. But then when I went and I looked at the book, knowing what H.G. Wells had in mind, and I don't think that he wrote any of his, quote, fiction works
mm-hmm.
without injecting this somehow, some way.
Yeah.
And I look at the Eloys and the Morlocks, and I'm saying, that seems pretty much to me where everything's going.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
I think so. I mean, H.G. Wells, he wasn't a little man who typed it under a candle or anything. He had a building, a whole building with floors of secretaries and typists, and even had a printing shop in there, all supplied and backed by the British government. He was a propagandist for the British government.
Yeah.
And right down to the phrases, the war to end all wars, that was his, you know.
Well, you know, when you look at two of his titles, which are out there on the net, people can read them online, they are there extant. I mean, how do you just brush away those two titles, The Open Conspiracy and New World Order?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there it is right in your face.
Yeah.
But at this time, I just want to let everybody know, you listen to The Grassy Knoll, this is Viz. We have with us Alan Watt. Alan, are the three titles that you have to offer that you embrace in the Cutting Through series, do you treat matters like what we're talking about?
I do to an extent. The first two really are written in a completely different style to try and wake up people. It's a gestalt-like method so that your brain has to work as you're reading it.
Okay.
You're not getting passively downloaded and the stuff you'll forget. So, it's a different way of putting certain things across, but I also point out things which should be so obvious to them, which are not, you know. And I'm trying to show them that their survival capabilities have been somehow nullified or definitely blunted. And this is all by design, of course. So I try to shake them out of it by showing them things which are beyond coincidence,
mm-hmm.
Right down to the language itself. which was designed in the 1500s, the English language, to contain all of these double-speak meanings and so on. That's no coincidence whatsoever, because the Francis Bacon and John Dee, who helped create it, wrote about it, you know. So, I'll give an example. I mean, the name, the word con, Kohan, Cain, all mean the same thing.
Okay.
It's all mean, and king even, you see.
Mm-hmm.
These are all dialectical variations of the same word. And really, Kohan and Can and Con mean priest, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So, you take even the system itself, which began, we're told the beginning of this phase of the civilization began at Sumer, and you put the two words together and you're Consumer, you know. I mean, I kid you not.
I know. I'm sitting here going, yeah. Oh.
Mm-hmm. And you'll find this all through the English language, all these strange coincidences, right down to supposedly if you transformed the language so many times by different peoples, etc., etc., how come that the actual word, not the titles of the sun god of ancient Egypt, but the general word for the sun was the sun, you know? And a man's offspring, male, was also a son, and that was the same in Egypt. How could that be? Unless, of course, there are priesthoods literally coming down through the ages who understand this ancient technique of language creation and know that the key to control is the language itself. Your language is no different from a computer. A programmer who programs that computer technically should be able to be given a question, and he should know by the logic of the computer and the language he's given it the conclusion that computer must come to. And our language is exactly the same one. It's formed the same one.
In the books that you've written, do you contain a bibliography at all?
I do mention different books through it.
Mm-hmm.
Once in a while, if someone asks me, I'll put in an extended one for them, you know, if they want to go on the paper trail, and that's what it is, it's a paper trail, you know.
Well, it's not so much for verification. I admit there might be something to it, but what I'm given to do, and I have for a long time, is that when I've heard authors and on talk shows, of course, it's always piqued my interest, and then I've gotten their works, then I like to go and see what they've looked at also. And I mean, if anything else, it's just it resonates with what that particular author did, and then you have to say, well, the body of evidence kind of proves it, you know, or points to the fact that this is in fact true.
Uh-huh.
And also for those who are slow to come to the point that that this world has been run by conspiracy forever, to have a body of work at your fingertips isn't such a bad thing.
Yes. Okay.
Now your books are available if people will send. They're $25 a piece for three titles, is that correct?
Yeah.
And it would be appreciated if you would send, especially people in the States, international money orders. Are you planning to add anything to that? Is that pretty much those three titles, volumes or whatever, the end of the road?
No. I mean, I can go much, much further. I've been teaching a lot of people over the years. Mainly by phone.
Okay.
But I can go much, much, much further, absolutely. But you can't just hand all this to people who
no.
It'd be so alien to them that they couldn't go that far because it's so brand new to them. Anyone can talk about the conspiracy. It's so well detailed and out there. But as to all of the factors that came into play long ago and are still going on right to the present time and into the future, a lot of people can't step out of that comfort zone of what they think is reality and go into the next phase because it will be really bizarre, you know, if they haven't gone a step-by-step process to understand all of this.
Isn't it interesting, though, Alan, that people will go to horror movies, they'll go to sci-fi movies, they want to be scared by what they consider, you know, fantasy.
Yeah.
But then when you take a look deeply, that much of what we've considered science fiction and fantasy is in fact true. And then when people realize that, now we get a different situation.
In the late 1800s, the Rothschilds created a foundation in England to encourage authors to write about certain topics which the Rothschilds defined.
That wouldn't be Tavistock, would it?
Tavistock eventually became part of it. And so they were trying to start off science fiction writers.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Tavistock later gave the term to this process, where you read novels, now it's watching movies, but then it was novels aimed at the young, to make those young people excited about this imaginative future that could be brought forth. And Tavistock calls it predictive programming.
There you go.
So that's what all fiction really has been for, from then on, at least, maybe even before. But this process is well understood. When you're getting a lecture on something, you have a little sensor there that kicks out certain things you won't believe or disagree with. But when it comes to fiction, that sensor part is down. And mm-hmm. So you're wide open. You're being downloaded with possibility thinking, as they call it. And so something that would sound nuts, if you were not brainwashed with this kind of material, actually starts to sound quite natural. So we think we're evolving along a natural path. And we don't question why NASA is given billions of dollars, and yet it's a highly secretive society. Everybody in NASA has to be a 33rd degree, at least, you know, or 32nd.
Ooh.
And of course, NASA's main job is not just going out into space. It's also to create satellites and so on that will spy on us for this great network we're making. But they had to get everybody for 50 or 60 years or more to grow up thinking that this is a natural progression.
With science fiction writers, which I think, I guess we can start with, I guess to a certain extent, I mean, you can go back to Bacon talking about, what was the title of his book? About Atlantis, the new Atlantis, right?
He wrote some, actually there's a whole bunch of titles. In fact, I doubt it was just really just one man, because he wrote so many books.
But the seminal work is The New Atlantis, is it not?
He wrote that around the same time. Moore wrote Utopia.
Uh-huh.
And it was basically along the same lines, but The New Atlantis was to be an Atlantis-type colony created in the Atlantic, which was the U.S., of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it would give it an appearance on the surface of being run by a form of input by the public, but in reality, he said, it'd be run by a secret group of scientists. And he meant social scientists and so on, you know,
all right,
what
we
call psychologists.
With modern science fiction writers, say in the 20th century, and I think besides Wells, most of them pop up around 1950 or so. And, you know, I think back to Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451,
yep.
Burgess's Clockwork Orange, Brave New World by Huxley.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that they were, and Philip K. Dick's books,
mm-hmm.
okay, take whatever you want, you know, Minority Report or Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep.
Yeah.
Do you believe that they were handled? Do you think some of them were handled? Do you think, even if they were or weren't handled, that they were given a glimpse into what was going to come?
Well, there's no doubt. I mean, Huxley himself gave a talk at Berkeley University in 1967.
62, just before he died.
62, yeah.
That's right.
And he actually mentioned in that talk that he had been to Tavistock many times. He was connected with Tavistock.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the only time he became animated is when he talked about how these wires in people's brains could mean that people could be controlled. So that's when he became animated and excited. He thought this was fantastic. So yeah, he was deeply involved with Tavistock, and once again given his material, and no doubt by a whole team of people, and he had to basically write the story around the data.
And also Burgess, then, you know, that famous last scene that is emblazoned in all our minds when Alex, you know, is all wired up.
Yeah.
So we're looking really probably what's happening today, especially with this unfortunate situation with this. Is torture okay or not? I can't even believe this is in the public dialectic.
Mm-hmm.
But really, they knew that this was all possible. In fact, and probably was already developed.
Yeah, absolutely. I was reading through the biography of Rutherford, who was the world's most famous mathematician in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And before 1920, he mentions in his own memoirs, he says, I was working on a project to do with human genes. Now, supposedly at that time, the human gene had never been found yet.
Mm.
Why would you be the mathematician?
Yeah. What's your answer?
The answer is that whatever we're told is obsolete news.
Well, I think we might have said in this series, you know, it spanned a couple of weeks, and I might have forgotten, but I remember that one woman saying, you know, if you hear about it now, it was in R&D 50 years ago.
Absolutely. There's no doubt in Francis Bacon's New Atlantis, in the last chapter, and again, he goes through the virtues, the Masonic virtues, etc., and Bacon himself was a Rosicrucian, which is one of the first to set up the Freemasonic
right.
system. But he talks about, in the last chapter, about getting into the underground laboratories, where the whole complex is powered by the energy from something which gave us the light and heat of the sun. And that sounds like nuclear power.
Well,
and he said next door to it was a laboratory where they controlled the weather and could create hurricanes and storms and earthquakes, you know.
But you must understand, too, and I did this about, a couple of weeks ago. I mean, Alan, I mean, there's a paragraph in Orwell's 1984 that is just jam-packed. It's almost like somebody like who was talking on the phone and had to get off real quick just said, and this will happen, this will happen, this will happen. And he talked all about that.
Yeah.
I mean, Orwell said about the laboratories, you know, here and there and everywhere, about harnessing the sun, which we kind of think might be HAARP, and creating artificial earthquakes or tsunamis.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he resonates this as well. So, I mean, you know...
Well, you think about Bacon's New Atlantis, which was published, it was written in the late 1500s and published in 1602. And he's writing about this stuff in 1602. And he said another laboratory underground, they're all underground or inside mountains. Another laboratory said we can take the minutest form of plant life, add to it the basic life forms of other plants. He wasn't talking about slicing them. He said, and we can create a brand new species, he said. He said, we can do the same with any kind of animal life. And he said, we know what the end product will be before we begin, meaning it was not a new, we're not experimenting. They already knew the processes.
Holy
mackerel. And even breeding special mosquitoes to carry bacterium for warfare purposes.
I'm just sitting here thinking about the possibilities. You know, and all I've read, and as I said to you, I don't necessarily believe in the hollow earth theory completely, but something's going on subterranean.
Oh, they've always, I mean, even the Egyptians, I mean, Herodotus, who did a lot of the Egyptian histories for the Greeks, and who also was, like all of them, he was initiated into the mysteries himself. He had tours of the underground facilities under Egypt, and some of them went on for miles. And these were all man-made, you know. They were not, it's not a hollow earth. It's simply the best place to hide things from the prying eyes of the public.
Yeah.
And just as today, I mean, I was going over an old report by the Rand Corporation from the 1960s, and they'd built over 280 underground silos and containment places for the U.S. military then, and they were then demanding that they build at least another 400 to house the elite, etc., underground. So this has always been the way, is to hide things underground or inside mountains.
I want to go back to Freemasonry in the time that we have left to talk about how it is, I would think, the religion of the world, and that all the leaders are kind of hooked in.
Yeah.
And like we like to say, kind of, you know, somewhat sarcastically, they all know the handshake.
Mm-hmm.
But there is something I'm keeping my eye toward, and I'm going to ask you your take on this. Denver, Colorado, in the Rocky Mountain West, is very interesting in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that there are a lot of things there already, like NORAD and some super Cray computers.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the CIA recently stated that they were moving some functions out there. We all know about Denver Airport, how expansive it is for so little traffic, which even my non-conspiratorial pilot buddies will say they can't understand, and they're still building runways. You talk about the cavernous underground, which, if you can believe, Phil Schneider lost his life for talking about. And then you look at the name of the airport. Its true name is New World Airport.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a Masonic capstone there.
Yeah.
And so here's what I'm saying. Are we looking at the possibility that if it hits the fan in a nuclear sense,
mm-hmm.
that everything will be moved out to that area, and that everybody's going to hunker down out in, let's face it, Colorado has got mines. It's already got everything going for itself.
Mm-hmm.
Even Orwell talked about boring machines right back in 48.
Yeah.
So are we looking at a time when if it hits the fan, that when the new world arises, my feeling is that Denver probably will be the capital of the American Union. And, of course, D.C. will be absolutely smoked, and we will lose all connection to our old republic. That's a big of a mouthful, but how do you feel about that, Alan?
Yeah, they have plans for every possible contingency. And the U.S. also has another underground base built in Australia. Another branch of government will go to try and survive. Now, they're talking about some global disaster which they might bring on themselves. But traditionally, even in ancient times, the elite always had three. They always used the Trinity.
Mm-hmm.
And this mystery religion for everything. And we always had three places. So that if one was destroyed, perhaps the other two would survive. But they never put all their eggs in one basket.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they always have three.
Well, let's go to religions, and let's finish up with Freemasonry.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the global religion?
It is, yes, it is. I mean, Albert Pike stated it quite emphatically, that Freemasonry is a religion. And it has all of the usual things, ritualism, symbolism, their own mandates, you know. And it definitely is a religion. It's always been here. I think it was here long, long before the Rosicrucians came up. Mm-hmm. The noble orders had them. The Knights of the Garter were formed in St. John's Day.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, it's all for nobility. It was never given to the common people until they created the middle class to handle the factories. You know? So they had to give them a semblance of Freemasonry for that purpose. But it's interesting, too, that when the British troops went into India in the 1700s, they were flabbergasted to find that almost every town in India had a Masonic lodge.
Well, but I've talked to you about taking photos and keeping them for a later date to put up with regard to knowing the handshake. And, of course, there is that little peculiar handshake that has taken place
mm-hmm.
for as long as it's been photographs. And I find that interesting. It would seem to be emblematic of Freemasonry. But if that is the case, and I believe that to be true, every single government, and we talked before about Arafat, and you can talk about Sharon now, and you can talk about Blair and whatever, Churchill, everybody, United States,
mm-hmm.
and Saddam too, perhaps.
Yeah.
They're all in the brotherhood.
Yeah.
They all know the handshake, and they all play their parts.
Yes, they do.
Now, given that, I just got to ask you, what do you think the fate of Saddam will be, if in fact he's in the brotherhood?
We might get anything at all. It might say if you put him in a prison that no one can visit, similar to Hess, for example, the Spandau prison, and we'll never know if he's there or not. They might say that they've executed him. We'll never know if he did or not.
Unless it's public, and it's got to be, I hate to say, a beheading or an electrocution or a hanging.
Yeah.
And then, of course, everybody will say, well, that's a double.
They literally, I mean, seeing is believing, is like the dog kept telling us, and whatever they show us will appear to be real, and these are masters of deception, you know.
Absolutely.
They've been at this deceptive game forever. But as I say, when Arafat used to, when they're doing the peace treaties with Israel, you'd see him and the Prime Minister of Israel going through the 5 points of Freemasonry as they met each other. You know, it's hand to hand, and then hand to elbow, toe to toe, knee to knee, and then hand to round the back, as you'll see. You think they're just hugging each other, and then it's cheek to cheek, you know?
Well, a lot of people may not understand that. There is a procedure, or there is a greeting, if you will, a protocol, which this takes place, and it's on the net. Off the top of your head, and I have seen that, do you know anywhere, any website that people could go to go ahead and take a look at that?
Well, actually, to see it, I mean, I've got it written down from the old charges here in the first book.
You have it in the first book?
Yeah, this one was, I don't know, it was published around the 1700s. And it's from the Cathar Coronapi Lodge in London. That's their main research lodge for the Masons.
Well, isn't it interesting that Israel bore down on Arafat, and they could have killed him if they wanted to.
Yeah.
But it wasn't ordained.
Yeah, and he was an Egyptian. They couldn't do it, you know.
Oh, okay.
And red and white are the two lands of Israel. The white, together they formed the hat. There were two parts to the hat. One was white, one was red. And that's why they put that on there, to symbolize the ancient Egyptian lineage he belongs to.
You said hat?
Yeah.
Oh, would you expound on that a little bit?
The Egyptian kings wore a strange-looking hat.
Okay.
And it was a two-part hat with almost a white dome-type thing that stuck on the top of it.
Okay.
And each part represented ancient Egypt. The white part was for southern Egypt, and the red part for north. So a pharaoh who was in charge of the two lands, as they called them, wore the hat with the red and the white. The red symbolizes the fire and the blood, of course, for the ongoing revolution always. It's Kabbalistic as well, and it goes way back to Babylon. White is again the pure ones, the hidden masters of spirit, you know. Blue, of course, is for the openness of the sky, but it's also the first, but in the Kabbalah, it's the first color that comes from black. That's how they put it. So it's law. So the blue has another meaning, not just the open, it also means under law. And so it's the fire for the revolution, for the agenda. And the white for the hidden masters, meaning the spirit of them, the perfection is white. And then the blue is for under law.
Well, I'll feed into this to a certain point, because when I look back, yeah, I'm really not understanding how we embrace this symbol. Mm-hmm. We look at the star that is, in North Korea, in Russia, in Cuba, and with us. And it's like, you know, why did a star have 5 points? When I look up in the sky, I'm not really seeing a five-pointed object. So you know where I'm going. So in other words, we're looking at the star, and are we really looking at a pentagram?
Yeah. Yeah, I know. You're looking at a particular part. There are different points. It depends on the higher sect. In England, they have ones there with 8 points. And 8 is the number for new beginnings, but it's also the number for power and money, run by power and money. So the 5 point has its own particular function, and that's the exploration or the navigators, to call them. They are still going through a form of revolution. And those countries, remember, England was the first country to have a revolution, and then you get the red, white, and blue flags. The next one was the U.S., red, white, and blue, and then followed by France, which is red, white, and blue, too.
The English Revolution to which you're referring is which one?
That's the one when they ousted Charles, you know.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Should we divine anything from the fact that in the United States, which I'm starting to really realize was probably a training ground for a New World Order?
The old system used the exoteric lions, etc., on the unicorns, which all go back again to ancient India.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have the old occultic symbols, the lions again from Babylon, like the lion's gate at Babylon had the two rampant lions standing over its coat of arms. And somehow that ended up on the British coat of arms. But the U.S. was the first country to use the again, occult symbols from Babylon, but in an updated form. And they also were the first country to build an actually brand new obelisk.
Yep.
All the other countries from the old world took in obelisks from Egypt and put them in the main capital centers.
To include the Vatican, is that correct?
That's right. Well, actually, Constantine's son brought the one over to Rome. He was sent off with a mission to bring it in. And they initially set it up in the circus. And it was a much later pope who had it moved and brought in front of the window.
Well, should I divine anything from the fact that of all the colonies that could have turned to states, how many there were, that 13 was, is that a peculiar number?
No, it's the number for the resurrection of Osiris, Egypt.
Because of the lost, the found 13 parts?
Yeah, he was chopped up.
Right, and the 14,
the 13
right.
Parts, that's right.
Typhon.
And so, technically, the 14th part is the what they call the lost word.
Well,
also the lost word.
Well, if that's the case, then, if we're looking at 13 colonies that turned to states,
yep.
isn't it interesting that D.C. would not be a state but the 14th part?
That's right.
In which we have the obelisk known as the Washington Monument,
mm-hmm.
which is 555 feet, which is multiplied by 12 inches, equals 6660.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's not a coincidence, is it?
Oh, no. These guys don't do it. They love to. They're obsessional about numbers and occult numbers.
But, you know, the thing is, I've never really questioned, Alan, before talking to you right this very moment, why the district would be the district. I mean, why? I mean, I guess I look at the city of London, and we always think of London, but I think you would tell me that within London, there's the city of London.
That's right.
All right, so he would look at the district, which knows no state,
mm-hmm.
and very well might have been the 14th part to the 13 states.
Yes.
All right, so
and of course, D.C., if you would speak that, and instead of just spell out the letters, D.C., this in French, is 10.
Right.
And 10 is the binary code that's all through masonry, and all through language, actually, and computers. It's mm-hmm. a binary code. It's a very high, it's a male and female, you know, as well.
Well, I'm gonna leave with a question, which, you know, I don't know how you're going to feel, but before we do that, I want to say that this is the Grassy Knoll, this is Biz. We have with us Alan Watt. He has three books. It's a cutting through series. As he said, it's a companion to many of the interviews and all the interviews he has done. Now, what I want to ask you about numerology as we leave this the show, 9/11,
yeah.
Is that spiritually / occult important?
There's no doubt. I mean, the old number in England for years on the telephone for emergency response. When I was growing up, was 999.
Okay.
And of course, it was the old dial phone, so when you turned that dial, it would turn to 666. You see?
Okay.
And so that was no coincidence. So yeah, when they give you an emergency number, it's highly, highly significant. And 9, is completion in their symbology. 11 are the two pillars. Jason and Boaz, representing fire and water, the male and the female. So fire, again, is the agenda, the spirit of revolution towards a goal, and water, technically, in a sense, is represents the earth as well, the mother matter, that's where the word comes from, and tempered by that, in other words, you know, tempered by that side of it. So yeah, these are all highly significant, and they They never give you anything out there by coincidence.
I think not. Listen, Alan, thanks for spending the time that you have with us. I think perhaps if you're okay with this, we might want to revisit our discussions later on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And thank you for coming on to the Grassy Knoll, and we'll be in touch. And you and all yours have a very safe winter up there.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye.